Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty by Elizabeth Mitchell. And Elizabeth joined us on the line this morning. Good morning, Elizabeth. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning.
So there is a tale to tell, and it's a very complex tale. There are lots of lots of pieces, parts to it. Why did you decide to undertake such a mission?
Well, I was in the library in New York in the manuscript division, and I was researching something else. I came across Bartholdi's diary from when he came to America in 1871. And when I started reading it, I realized that he had had this idea beforehand. He was pitching it to a country he'd never visited, and he wasn't particularly in love with America. And it was also very clear that he was a lone wolf trying to get this thing done. He had a few friends back in France who supported it, but otherwise he was on his own. So that story just fascinated me, somebody who sets out to build a colossus and then makes it happen.
Was it simply that, okay, Frederick is an artist, I'm an artist, I want to do this, maybe somebody will help me do it? Was that pretty much it?
That's pretty much it, yeah. He had been to Egypt as a young man. He had traveled there, you know, under the sort of blessing of the French government, and he saw the sphinxes and the pyramids, and he was overwhelmed with that, and he loved the fact that that seemed like something that would last for all time. And so he had this vision of creating a colossus, and he first designed it actually for Egypt.
So New York was not the number one choice.
No. I mean, he would have been happy to have it at the mouth of the Suez Canal. At that point, it was supposed to be a slave woman, but she was still holding a torch, and she had the robed, you know, figure and a headdress and all that. But the deal fell through there, so he sat on it for a few years. He had to weather the Franco-Prussian War, and then he came to America with his design.
Elizabeth, this book is filled with so many facts of getting the record straight. Things that we thought all along were true are not true at all. So it was not a gift from the French government. It was not destined for New York in the beginning. And Thomas Edison wanted to make it talk.
That's one of my favorite little facts I came across. Yes, when Edison announced that he had invented the phonograph, there was all sorts of coverage of him in the papers. And he said, you know, I am also right now designing this monster disc to put inside the Statue of Liberty, which had not been built yet, but people knew that it was coming. And he said, it will amplify the sound through compressed air so that people in the northern part of Manhattan will be able to hear it and across the bay. And his idea was that it would suddenly just start giving speeches. We'd be walking through the streets and hear this.
Kind of ahead of his time, I guess. Thomas Edison, by the way, born just about 20 miles away from here, so close connection there. Elizabeth, in Chapter 13, you talk about the money and the funding, and oftentimes with projects, whether it's art or public projects, whatever, sometimes things don't go as planned. There are cost overruns. Take us through that process and how it turned out to be more costly than originally thought.
Well, just if you even start with the fact that when America first started promoting the idea that maybe a statue of this size would be coming to America, they also were not quite clear on how much money they would have to pitch in. The French had accumulated about what was then around $250,000 of funds. It might have been much more. It's hard to say because there's a little bit of question around the funding, but the Americans had to ante up the money for the pedestal and for putting it in place. And so they also had to create this pedestal. And so when there's this General Charles Stone, who was a Civil War hero, but who had fallen into disgrace, and he basically was trying to get this thing done as to save his name. When he started digging, he's hitting sand. You know, he comes across these ammunition depots there that he has to explode. Everything is costing more and more money. And there was one moment where they had only a stump of the pedestal. They ran out of money, and the statue sitting in Paris, and just work stops. I mean, it's dead. Nothing's happening. And that was when, you know, Bartholdi could have easily have despaired and, you know, it would have been the end.
Elizabeth Mitchell is our guest today. The book is called Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty. Elizabeth, when I look at pictures of the statue, and I I have not been there. I have not been up close to see it. It often looks to me like it's made of stone. What is it really made of?
It's really made of copper, and actually the metal is extremely thin. It's only the thickness of two pennies stacked together. So there has to be this scaffolding in, to hold it in place. And in fact, it's Gustav Eiffel, who made the Eiffel Tower, who made the original scaffolding. He then went on to make the Eiffel Tower, and it's a little funny that he made it a bit bigger than the Statue of Liberty, so almost immediately trumped the Statue of Liberty's claim to being one of the tallest structures in the world.
So made of copper, once upon a time, was it shiny copper like a penny?
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, when I went through the research, it appears that no one really predicted it would turn this green color. They thought it would become a kind of darker copper color, but there's nothing. They were worried, in fact, about how dark it appeared. And at one point, Bartholdi, after the statue had been put up, said, you know, I think the next thing we should do is gild her, you know, cover her in gold, because it would make her shinier. People would be able to see her better in all kinds of conditions. But of course, by that point, everyone is exhausted with the whole project, and they just, you know, put it aside.
Could they possibly go back now and sort of restore it to the copper penny look?
I think it would be like a Sisyphean endeavor. Basically, it's sitting out in the ocean air. You know, I mean, it's kind of amazing it's even still standing because it's metal. It has these iron bracings, which they always had to figure out a way to not turn it into a massive battery. You know, there was this worry that it would suddenly be electrically charged because of the combination of the salt air and the two metals combining. It just will always go to that color. I mean. And so I think they decided, you know what, this is pretty good. You can see it a little bit better than you would if it were a darker hue. But, yeah, it would be fascinating to see it, you know, if we could get a glimpse. Some of those photos, you can tell a little bit what it would look like. But it's, you know, they were black and white. So, you know, you don't really get the sense of the color.
On the top, we have what appears to be, I guess, a crown. I don't know. Spikes coming off the top. What was behind that design?
Well, there are some depictions of the Colossus of Rhodes, which was this legendary massive harbor statue, and in fact was one of Bartholdi's inspirations. This, you know, was around several millennia ago, and it had that headdress, and that was because it was a tribute to Apollo, the god of the sun. When Bartholdi was a very young man, when he was 22 years old, he got a piece in the Salon, which was the part of the World Exposition in Paris, and on the building that was the main headquarters of the whole fair, there was this figure that represented France that had that same headdress. So I think that, and he had a photo of that in his archives. So I think that he probably was using that as a reference point. But, you know, so I think it's mainly those two things.
When was the Statue of Liberty finally completed?
It was inaugurated in October of 1886. So it was a very long haul for him.
So did Bartholdi then actually get to see it? He lived until the early 1900s.
That's right. He pulled the veil off the face of the statue at the inaugural. The funny thing, though, is, you know, in my book, I kind of point out how he was a bit of an egotist, you know, as one would have to be to come up with a scheme like that. And so he was supposed to wait for this cue in order to pull the French flag from the face and reveal her to the world. But instead, he heard his name being mentioned in a speech, and the people started screaming, Bartholdi, Bartholdi. And in his enthusiasm, he ripped it off her face. And so she was unveiled a little early.
Always an artist. There you go.
Yeah.
I imagine, too, over
we
time.
We need them.
Yeah. Over time, you've had a chance to get up close and personal with the statue, right? You've been there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been there. Sandy closed it for a while, but.
Did you get any kind of feeling from that experience? What was your feeling from that experience?
Well, I've even been there in the last couple of weeks. And the thing that's interesting is it is always quite astounding when you're there. I mean, it's a very impressive piece. And then also there's this way in which it's amazing how big it has to be in order to overwhelm us. You know, when Bartholdi went there for the last time after the inaugural, he would come back in later years. But this is the moment it had been brought to the world. He said, he was there on a rainy night. It was, you know, sparkling and all the rest. And he said that it was odd because he had lost the sense of the immensity of it as he had when he was working on it in Paris, because he used to be climbing all over it. And he said, "It's going away from me. It's going away from me." I think when you see the little people up there, it is really remarkable that it has to be that scale in order for us to realize that it's monumental. You know, sometimes it even looks small. So it's quite a feat.
Well, if you haven't been there, like me, you can take a trip back in time and find out about, well, really everything that went into getting it done, getting it built, and having the inaugural. The book is called Liberty's Torch by Elizabeth Mitchell. Thank you for being with us. And of course, I'm sure we can pick up this book any place books are sold, right?
That's correct. Thank you so much for having me.